As an Australian, I'm outraged to see American evangelists get fat and rich on the exporting evangelism to Australia and the establishment of the US-inspired evangelical political campaigns in Australia. Now, just this year, there's been two revelations of financial loss. One was $94,500, money that went to the creation scientists. If it hadn't been for us making it public, and it would probably be never known by their supporters. Now, in New Life, if you read a recent issue, the Frankston Baptist Church has been taken over, given to liquidators. The congregation has lost their own church in Frankston, Victoria, led by the Reverend Payne, who used to be prominently as the Victorian coordinator of the Festival of Light. He hadn't spoken out in the Festival of Light for a while, and in fact, he's just taken a 6 months long service leave. Now, we have elaborate laws protecting exploitation, consumer affairs, trade practices, but we don't seem to have any in the area of religious fundraising and religious spending. In 1981, I heard about, for the first time, the American Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. And in 1981, I found that there's 162 evangelical organisations in America with a turnover of $700 million belonging to that organisation. Their rules include making audited balance sheets available on request and using the sort of bookkeeping rules that businesses use. Now, I believe that believers in a Christian God can take a lead from the American Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, and that one of these should be set up in Australia. Now, tonight, I call upon Dr. Montgomery to support my call for the setting up of an Australian Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, so that when you give your money to creation science, you know where it goes. You know that it won't end up at the bottom of the harbour. So that you know exactly that money you've put into funds is spent for those particular campaigns. The need for financial honesty in religion is as relevant today as it was in the days of the money lenders in the temple. And Dr. Montgomery has the opportunity tonight to call for the establishment of an Australian ECFA and to leave behind a legacy from which genuine Australian evangelists and all Australian Christians who contribute to evangelical causes can only benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Plummer. I now call on Dr. John Montgomery to speak on the topic humanism or Christianity, that the Christian God exists and is relevant today. Dr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Plummer, ladies and gentlemen. I would be delighted to have an Australian Council of Financial Accountability for Evangelical Organizations. But before we get that started, I'd like some sort of an organization that could ensure accuracy when non-Christians describe the nature of the Christian faith and of the Bible. Mr. Plummer's survey of biblical history is like Alice dropping down the rabbit hole into Wonderland. It's truly remarkable, and I can't resist starting with it. So that we at least get something resembling fact into this picture. Mr. Plummer and the humanists constantly emphasize scientific method, empiricism, going with the facts. But when they get to work on the Christian religion, anything resembling true Christianity is only by accident. For example, Mr. Plummer starts out talking about the Quran not having been altered, but the Bible changed every few years. The only reason the Quran has never been altered is that very early in the history of Islam, a caliph gathered all variant copies of it and arbitrarily burned all but one. That has eliminated any history of textual criticism of the Quran, but no one has any idea whether the existing text is the most accurate one or not. It's true that there are new translations of the Bible that come out constantly, but Mr. Plummer ought to compare the King James, which he likes, with any contemporary version, and he will discover that the overlap is roughly 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent, even though Erasmus Textus Receptus, on the basis of which the King James was translated, was based upon a very cursory sort of manuscript search. The reason for this is, of course, that, as Sir Frederick Kenyon, principal librarian of the British Museum, said before his death, there is no work of antiquity which has better textual sources for it than the Bible. Even if you do a poor job, you still end up with a clear text. Mr. Plummer says that we've given up the notion that the world was created 6,000 years ago. You surely must realize that that comes from Bishop Usher's chronology in the 17th century. It's not at all demanded by the biblical text. You must assume, first of all, that the genealogies of the Old Testament are complete in order to make that calculation. They obviously aren't. The genealogies of the Old Testament, like the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, give only the major figures, not everybody. The expression X begat Y doesn't mean father to son. It means from an important representative to another important representative. God is supposed to have condemned everybody for one man's act. Mr. Plummer, do you know Hebrew?
No, it's one of the many languages I haven't yet mastered.
I see. Well, you should get to work on it before you start dealing with the meaning of the Old Testament, because it was written in Hebrew. If you check Genesis 1, you'll find that the word for Adam, as a matter of fact, is exactly that in the Hebrew, Adam. It means mankind. Adam's act was a kind of representative sample of everybody's act. For that reason, it isn't a case of one person doing something and everybody else who's innocent getting the results of it. Had you been there, Mr. Plummer, presumably you would have done the same thing. Find me some reference to apple eating in the passage, if you will. There's no mention of it at all. Perhaps that's a small point, but it indicates a lack of care and accuracy when you deal with the biblical materials. If you believe that scientific method should be used, why don't you employ it? Why don't you try to deal with the exact facts and not create stereotypes? You go through a list of the evils of the Old Testament. My question to you is, what possible standard as a humanist do you have for determining what is evil as compared with what is good? If you believe that we have all crawled up from primeval slime and we really turn out to be nothing other than animals, there is obviously no transcendent standard of morality by which it would be possible to judge anybody's acts. You stand in judgment on the God of the Old Testament, and I suppose you have every right to do this, but I'd like to have you establish a standard of morality on the basis of which you have a right to do this. Wittgenstein says in the Tractatus, after dealing with the question of ethics, he says, let me get the exact quotation here. I have it someplace. Yes, here it is. Here it is. Says Wittgenstein, ethics is transcendental, meaning that you've got to establish a standard independent of the human condition, otherwise the standard is constantly in flux and simply ebbs and flows according to your opinions. You may not realize this, but humanists have not all maintained what is apparently the high morality that you've set forth. We have, for example, Friedrich Nietzsche in the 19th century, who, after declaring that God is dead, substituted the Übermensch, the Superman, where might is right, and it's possible for the strong man to crush the weak. I'm not saying that your standards necessarily have anything the matter with them, but you can't use those standards to judge anybody else unless you can first of all vindicate them. Do I support capital punishment? As a matter of fact, I don't care for capital punishment, but that doesn't mean I'm a poor Christian. You've got to make a distinction between what goes on in the specific and limited history of Israel and what God commands for the nations in general and for people today. The Israelite situation was a specialized situation for many reasons, and you can't just jump automatically from the Old Testament to the New, or consider that Christians necessarily have got to be doing what God commanded people to do in the Old Testament. As for Jesus' recommendation of castration, hating parents, and deserting wives and children, I'm sure that you wouldn't want people to put the worst construction on your writings, and that's, of course, exactly what you've done with the biblical materials. Jesus said that it would be better for a person to enter into the kingdom without his private parts than to enter into hell with them. That didn't mean that he was out cutting off people's private parts. He said that in terms of ultimate values, it is essential that a person consider his relationship with God more important than his relationship with his parents. And as far as the desertion of wives and children, he never advocated that at all. He said the same sort of thing, that one has to get his values straight. And of course, one of the most serious problems in humanism is that values are inverted. It isn't possible to see the values lined up as they really ought to be. Then, running through this whole presentation, there is bad logic. Bad logic. There's a kind of statistical fallacy running all the way through. Christians are not in the majority. What difference does that make? Do we determine truth by consensus gentium? Do we count ears and divide by two, and thereby determine who ought to be correct and who's wrong? A higher crime rate in the U.S. than in Australia, lower in Japan? Mr. Plummer, have you ever heard the sad story of the statistician who drowned wading across a river with an average depth of 3 feet? You must realize that societal life is very complex. You can't line up the crime rate with the religion factor and expect that that's going to explain it. The low crime rate in Japan has to do, for example, with the particular and peculiar attitude toward the family in Oriental society, etc. Guilt by association. You talk about Jim Jones' fundamentalism. Are you aware that Jim Jones was a Marxist, that he used Christian language in order to convince his followers that they ought to go along with him, that he actually, by trickery, convinced them that he was suffering from stigmata, bleeding from the hands, this sort of thing. And anyway, when he did present the Christian message, it wasn't anything resembling that of classical Christianity. On the evangelist's money, no one's been sending me any from Australia, and I feel depressed after what I've heard from you. I see you've been reading Time magazine this last week, that fine source of scholarly information on religion, and it seems to me that we ought to recognize that in this discussion, what we're dealing with is not Evangelist A or Evangelist B with Herbert Armstrong or Jerry Falwell, whose name, by the way, is spelled J-E-R-R-Y, not G-E-R-R-Y, as in some of the literature that I got from the humanists. Our concern here is presumably with Jesus Christ. Was he the person he claimed to be, and is there sufficient evidence that he actually was that person? That's the key to the whole thing, and there's no sense in trying to divert this thing by pushing it into all kinds of peculiar byways. Now, let me say something on the truth issue in this discussion. It seems to me that there are really two questions that we have to face in connection with this debate. The first is, what about the existence of God? Is God de trop? Is he unnecessary? Can we engage in a reductionistic elimination of God a la Durkheim or Freud? Or are there certain facts that you just can't explain adequately unless you do appeal to the existence of God? And secondly, as I've just said, what about Jesus Christ? As far as the existence of God is concerned, it's very interesting to me that when one looks at the application of such principles as Elber's paradox and the second law of thermodynamics, one ends up necessarily with a finite universe. Elber's paradox has been discussed in detail in Yaki's work on this subject, Yaki of the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton, and Yaki concludes that the universe must be finite because of the stellar phenomena which have a peculiar characteristic. And in even a popular work, such as Isaac Asimov's work on astronomy, an attempt is made to estimate the probable radius of the finite universe. I think that Asimov is off by a couple of kilometers, but this is a serious attempt to argue that the universe cannot be regarded as infinite. Now, if the universe is finite, that, of course, means logically that there's something out there and beyond it. And the second law of thermodynamics, of course, points to the fact that we cannot look at the universe as the atheist does, as having been in existence infinitely. If it were in existence infinitely, then there would have been more than enough time to reach heat death. Entropy would have reached a maximum, and you and I wouldn't be able to be here energetically discussing this whole question. This shows that the universe must be accounted for from outside. Either there was a creator that started at a finite amount of time ago, and in doing so, it hasn't had enough time to reach heat death, or there is a cosmic gas station attendant out there somewhere feeding energy in. And in either case, we are in a position where we really have to face the transcendent. Where Jesus Christ is concerned, we have a phenomenon that humanism and atheism have just not been able to treat. The reason for this is that Jesus not only claims to be God, and claims like this have been present through the centuries, I admit, in other religions. He not only claims to be God, he lays it on the line. He presents himself as able to conquer the powers of death. He dies and he rises again. And this stuff is not in late mythology. This stuff is in the records of eyewitnesses who had contact with those events. The sad thing about humanism is, in my opinion, that it really doesn't come up to its own standards. It claims to go with the facts, but it is really a dogmatic system which will not go with the facts. Example, the Humanist Manifesto 2 says this: any new discoveries will but enlarge our knowledge of the natural. This means that no matter what evidence there is for the resurrection of Christ, no matter what evidence comes in from the second law of thermodynamics or Elber's paradox or anything else, this evidence is always forced into the Procrustean bed of the natural. This is invincible ignorance. The only proper empirical spirit is to take the evidence and go where the evidence leads. And that's exactly what I don't find in humanist circles. On the other hand, of course, there's a lot to be said of humanism. It presents human value and holds it high. What I'm offering to you, Mr. Plummer, is an approach to the universe which will not take away from your humanism. It'll give it back to you, established on a solid basis. By way of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ, you can get an absolute value system which will establish man's value, and you can then have some reason for looking at the evils in the world today and attempting to do something about them. The sad thing is that as it stands, you are presenting an ideal that is totally without foundation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Montgomery. This is an opportunity for the two speakers to engage each other in a fairly brief debate and making points. The time limit is 2.5 minutes. I don't want to apply that stringently. The spirit of it is to make brief comments and rebuttal and to respond to those and to make further points. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr.
Plummer. I'm glad that Dr. Montgomery supports the setting up of the Australian Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. If I can summon up the courage to perhaps speak to the odd journalist or two, we might get a media story out of that. And certainly I hope it will be reported in the media press, particularly New Life, which was reported a great deal on Dr. Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery has set out his own personal view on capital punishment. The Bible sets out its view very clearly, over and over again. Christians in America, the far right, the fundamentalists, have been in favour and pushing for more capital punishment. If we'd had capital punishment, Lindy Chamberlain would have been hung before they found the jacket. I'm pleased Dr. Montgomery doesn't support the world going back 6,000 years ago, and I hope he'll go up to Sunnybank, Queensland, and tell the Creation Science Foundation, who are currently spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of Australia's money in one of the biggest religious campaigns in Australia in recent years, that they're wrong. Dr. Montgomery sees a need for a standard of values independent of the human condition. He is assuming that the Bible, it has, of course, a supernatural base. If the Bible is only made by men, is only the words of men, then the values in it have no more weight than other value systems. And having looked at the values expressed in it, having considered them, I could not accept those values. I could not accept those values as one on which we could build laws, on one on which we could live a life. He criticised me on Jerry Falwell. Now, I spelt Jerry Falwell correctly in my article, Televangelism, I've got it here, people can check that. The Christian press in Australia, having approached the New South Wales Humanist Society, first of all said it was a debate with the sceptics, then said it was a debate with the Australian humanists, and tonight said it was the New South Wales Humanist Association. We still haven't got them to learn the title, let alone the spelling. Now, Dr. Montgomery offers to give me an absolute value system. There are many competing absolute value systems proclaimed by different theological groups around Australia. Some of them have got into power, and we can see what happens in Iran. Now, in Iran, the theocrats proclaim that you can send out young kids to die for God, to die for Allah. You can't excuse that sort of behaviour because Iran is in a particular religious mode, and neither can you disclaim the behaviour set out in the Bible because Dr. Montgomery feels that it was appropriate for that particular time, era and circumstance. Thank you.
I apologise for that. It's the name society. I was given the name association.
Would it be easier if we stood up here together? This hopping back and forth is rather awkward.
Just stay apart.
Mr. Plummer, I realize that you can't or won't accept the biblical value system, and I'm perfectly well aware that there are a wide variety of different value systems in the world. But that's not my question. My question to you is, what is the justification for your personal value system on the basis of which you've engaged in the ethical criticisms that you've presented here?
Well, the reason I support humanism is that firstly, it has a belief in science, that it's provable, that it's based on values that can be tested. Secondly, I support it because it is not set down by a group of men proclaiming themselves authoritarian, hierarchical men, but is rather one that has evolved through a long history of parliamentary democracy involving men and more recently women. And it is amazing how the value system proclaimed by the Christian Church in so many churches precludes women from having an equal role in the teaching of and the proclaiming of the Christian value system.
Yes, my question wasn't about the treatment of women in Christian churches. It was, how do you establish, how do you justify the humanist value system that you've accepted? The fact that it isn't proclaimed by a church, instead it's proclaimed by a group of humanists such as Paul Kurtz, doesn't in itself, it would seem to me, establish it. Unless you are falling into the authoritarianism that you're always condemning Christians for. Where do you get this system? And more important than where you get it, why is that value system a sufficient basis for the criticisms you've engaged in?
Because to my mind, that value system is based on the evolution of a system of moral values by men judging what is right and judging what is wrong without needing to refer back to a supernatural being which I don't believe exists. So I'm glad Paul Kurtz's name is mentioned because he will be in Sydney next month, April the 4th, and have a public meeting. He can all come.
Ah, that's very nice. Yes, nothing like commercials. But you have visited America, yes. Let's bring this down into very concrete terms. I mentioned Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche rejected supernaturalism. He rejected the revelation of God in Scripture. He, in fact, wrote a work entitled The Antichrist, in which he said that we shouldn't be weak and sweet like Jesus. Instead, it was a question of the transvaluation of values and the will to power, and that might makes right. Now, there is a secular value system. You don't accept that. I want to know why your secular value system is better than that one on your own grounds. And if you can't say this, of course, you've opened up Pandora's box. It then becomes possible on your secular basis for people to move in Nietzsche's direction just as readily as they can move in your direction.
Yes, because of free will, people can move in different directions, but the people have, through the ballot box, through our institution of values, the judiciary, other systems been able to pull them back when they go off to a moral value that is unacceptable. Now, I'd like to
hang on,
you've got a few questions. Now, I'd like to ask...
Let Mr. Plummer...
Yes. Right. I forgot what I was going to ask you. You see... right. I'd like to ask you why you don't support capital punishment when it's so clearly laid out as being the Lord's word in so many direct quotes from the Bible.
Where is it specifically commanded for our time in the Scripture?
In other words, you're saying that Scripture laws have a time limit? You're saying that Scripture laws have a time limit? That when, the Bible expired at a certain age?
When the New Testament states that the ceremonial laws and the national legislation of Israel are abrogated, that means that I am no longer to go out and deal with prostitutes as Israel dealt with them, nor am I to go and engage necessarily in capital punishment. The New Testament actually doesn't say that I either must or I should not engage in capital punishment. The New Testament principle is in Romans 13, which says that government has an essential role to play, and therefore one operates in terms of the ordinances of government, except insofar as they violate other New Testament statements. But it's up to you. You have the burden to show that because in Israel capital punishment was commanded, that therefore it's supposed to take place in Scotland or in the United States.
You've just put a time limit, and you've said that the Old Testament has a time limit.
Sorry, I didn't put
the
it.
The birth of Christ?
Much as I would have liked to write the Bible, I didn't write
but
it.
No, you haven't written the
there
Bible.
It is.
I quite have to accept that you didn't write the Bible.
Yes.
What I am prepared to accept is that tonight you have stated that there is a time limit on certain Old Testament laws, and I want to know what's that cutoff date?
The cutoff date is the coming of Christ, the new covenant.
Amen.
How can you be so sure that the people who wrote the New Testament were unaware of the fact there may be some second cutoff date, that other areas of the Bible have cutoff dates?
Well, if you think that they did hold that, just show us where it is.
No, I'm saying the people in those days weren't aware of the fact that there may be some sort of time limit to the laws they have set out in the New Testament.
Really? If you read the book of Acts, you will find that, for example, the dietary laws related to the Old Testament are specifically abrogated in reference to the activities of the early church. You'll find in Colossians that it says that there are neither new moons nor Sabbaths any longer, so it's no longer a legal requirement for people in the New Covenant to operate with the Sabbatarianism that existed in the Old Covenant. Now, these are expressly set down. Your problem, Mr. Plummer, is that you're out of your depth. You really don't know what the Bible is saying on these subjects because you approach it with the prejudice that it's got to be naive, primitive, and Neanderthal.
No. I approach the Bible by looking at the literal word of the Bible that so many of your fellow Christians believe is the literal word, whereas you seem to be the one that is going into interpretations to what the Bible said, particularly in the way that you're interpreting away sections of the Old Testament that you don't like.
Incidentally, are you going to remain wandering about in the Old Testament forever, or could we get to the issue on which the truth of Christianity rests, namely Jesus Christ?
No. I quoted several areas of what Jesus Christ has said, but I've also had a look at numerous other faiths. I've no intention of spending my entire life just studying Christianity. In fact, Paul Kurtz invented a word called agnostic, which meant that perhaps the whole question was just irrelevant. And a Krishna said to me the other week, Mr. Plummer, until you have read all the books of the Bhagavad Gita, you just can't understand the Hare Krishna faith. And I had a Mormon around the other week. I didn't ask him what underpants he was wearing, what sacred garments he had on, but he said that until I had read the Book of Mormon and all the other sections, I really couldn't understand Mormonism. Life is too short. I don't intend to spend the rest of my life adding on little bits of knowledge about Christianity because I've already satisfied myself that gods don't exist, gods and goddesses don't exist, and there's not much more evidence for the Christian God.
Let me stop you right there. Are you saying that there is... Excuse me. Are you saying that there really isn't anything that could convince you?
Oh, yes, there'd be lots that could convince me.
For example?
Right. If miracles came back and were scientifically tested, we know a lot more about the miracles of Jesus Christ. We know a lot more about miracles and the way to see whether people's personal observations are correct or not. In this very city...
But I'm a lawyer also, Mr. Plummer, and I don't believe that we know anything more about the reliability or unreliability of testimony than people did in the first century. I think that it's as easy or as difficult to tell whether a person is alive or dead today as it was in the first century. Eating fish, for example, is an excellent indication as to whether a person is alive or dead, and Jesus was munching away on it subsequent to his crucifixion.
A great number of faith healers cheering around. Why do they turn up in church halls, open-air meetings, Why don't they come into our hospitals? Every city's got a hospital full of people who would love to be cured. People who have been fully diagnosed beforehand. These faith healers are quite welcome to come in. I can arrange doctors who would be quite happy to have faith healers come in and work on people who have been fully diagnosed and under scientifically controlled conditions produce the same results that they appear to produce under unscientifically controlled conditions.
Question to Dr. Montgomery. Yes, this gentleman in the green shirt.
Dr. Montgomery, would you please comment on that answer?
On the answer that was just given, I'm appalled that the humanist didn't offer me that much money to come here. I prefer not to comment on this because it does not seem to me that the type of evidence which was just spoken about is the central evidence that we ought to be concerned about here. The problem here, it seems to me, is the truth of Christianity versus the truth of humanism. And the truth of Christianity depends upon the truth of Jesus Christ. It does not depend upon whether certain alleged healings happen at the present time or not, because even if we were to show that those healings occurred, we'd still have to bridge the gap between the healing and the theological claim made in connection with the healing. Now, I want to be very careful here. I'm not saying that such things do not occur. I know a professor at the University of Rochester School of Medicine who had a severe spinal problem. He was the head of the pathology department at the University of Rochester School of Medicine, which, in case you don't know it, is one of the most distinguished medical schools in the United States, on the level of Johns Hopkins. And this gentleman, after becoming a Christian, was miraculously healed. His spine, a fused spine, healed. And because he was a professor at the School of Medicine, of course, all of this had been tracked, and it occurred within a hospital setting. See? So I'm hardly denying this kind of thing, but it seems to me that if our purpose is not to advocate psychic healings, but our purpose is to determine the truth of Christianity, we ought to focus attention at another point.
All right. We'll start the cycle again here. Lady there.
Mr. Plummer, three questions ago, you put the onus on Christians to prove to you the existence of God and sat back and had a neutral view. Two questions ago, we were talking about Christians believing in heaven. Now, I'd like to present evidence to you. It is the person of Jesus Christ who died, came back, and said there is a heaven. Now, that is evidence. Could you explain why you still keep that neutral position? And if not, can you really say you're neutral?
Now, firstly, the question of people saying there is a heaven. In this day and age, we have a lot of people experiencing near-death experiences. People who are very sick, who are perhaps on operating tables or perhaps in hospitals at home sick, who say that they have gone to heaven, that they have floated off, that they thought they were dead, they saw a white light, they saw a tunnel, all sorts of things. We have a lot of modern testimony of people who claim they have gone to heaven. Merely statement of a claim is not proof of that claim. The fact that these people say they've had a near-death experience, the fact that they say that in this near-death experience, some of them are even clinically dead and the instruments on them are able to show that, doesn't necessarily mean that there is a heaven. It is merely what their own minds have constructed. Now, Jesus went to heaven. We have his word for that, as put down through the scriptures, but we don't have the sort of independent proof that either he did go to a heaven. You see what I mean? Just saying that someone said they claimed they went to heaven and they came back. People are doing that today. There are a lot of mythological legends about people claiming all sorts of things, having gone to other worlds, having gone to other spaces, but merely because they have made that claim is not sufficient proof of that claim.
Is there someone from here that would like to ask a question? This gentleman here to... you're welcome.
Montgomery. In the lead-up, I'm led to believe that you are a barrister.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, as a barrister, you must be interested in evidence. Facts supported by irrefutable evidence. What evidence have you got, or what evidence do you possess, that the Jesus of the Gospel was a historical person?
I can't stop them clapping.
This is going to take a couple of hours.
Try to keep it short, Dr. Montgomery.
I thought you'd never ask. No, I don't know the gentleman at all. No. First of all, the documents which present the life of Christ are primary source historical documents. That is to say, they were written by eyewitnesses or close associates of eyewitnesses, and those documents have reached us substantially in the same condition that they were originally written. Now, this is not simply an assertion on the part of clergy who would lose their salaries if that weren't the case. This is a matter of the application of the same principles of textual and historical analysis that are applied in the case of any documents. For example, Sir Frederick Kenyon, principal librarian of the British Museum, the foremost authority in textual criticism in modern times, had this to say. He said, in recent developments in the textual criticism of the Greek Bible, the New Testament text is far better attested than that of any other work of ancient literature. Lawyers have concentrated on the testimony that appears in these sound historical documents. Thus, for example, a gentleman schooled in such analysis by the name of Simon Greenleaf did a work in the 19th century entitled The Testimony of the Evangelists, and he put, as it were, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John on the witness stand to see if their testimony to Jesus Christ would hold up in a common law court. Greenleaf was the foremost specialist on common law evidence in both America and England. And today we have, for example, in reference to such testimony, and in particular the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which shows that Jesus is not merely presenting a claim, but he is actually offering proof of it, works by such jurisprudence as J.N.D. Anderson, Sir Norman Anderson, who just retired as head of the School of Advanced Legal Studies at the University of London. This is one little thing that Anderson has done, the evidence for the resurrection. The case goes like this. If you don't go along with the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, it's essential for you to be able to explain away this testimony in reference to the appearances over a 40-day period, which were not like the appearances of Fatima or whatever. These are specific appearances described in very careful detail, and the presence of a hostile audience makes it incredible that such material could get by if it weren't true. In Frank Morrison's work, Who Moved the Stone, Morrison says, look, there are only three interest groups involved in this situation. Mr. Plummer's already noted that the Romans had no interest in dealing with this. That leaves the Jewish religious leaders and the disciples. The Jewish religious leaders were the last ones to get rid of the body of Christ because it was against their interest. And the disciples, if they had gotten rid of the body and then gone out and proclaimed this thing, would have been literally dying for something they knew to be untrue. Now, people through the centuries have died for things that they thought were true and have not been. But it's a different thing to die for something you think is true and it isn't, and to die for something you know perfectly well is not true. This stuff has the ring of truth about it. It is not an act of deception on the part of those people, and even if they had tried to get away with it, they wouldn't have been capable of doing it in the presence of the hostile audience. So, we are left with the explanation of the rise of Christianity, primary records. If you want to get rid of this, you're going to have to dump your knowledge of historiography in the classical world. Are you prepared to do that, Mr. Plummer?
There's opportunity to respond. Obviously, Mr. Plummer's going to choose what responsibility summing up. This gentleman standing here would like to ask a question. To Mr. Plummer.
Doctor, you may notice I'm wearing hearing aids. Doctor. I'm wearing a hearing aid. This is to the doctor.
The question to me, isn't it?
The question is a clear lady.
No, I'll place the question to me.
It's supposed to be a question to Mr. Plummer.
No.
Would you like to ask a question to Dr. Montgomery?
Yes.
Well, can you wait till the next question? I'll be quite happy to invite you. There's a question right, an arm right at the back row went up. No, back row, not you. The gentleman with the glasses at the back row. Can you wait for the microphone?
Oh, I speak better without one.
There's people out the back who can't hear without the mic, so I have to have the mic.
I'd like not to just direct all questions on theology to Dr. Montgomery, because I understand that you have a fair grasp of some questions of theology yourself, Mr. Plummer. So I'd like to ask you, are there two Jesus factions in the New Testament, one represented by all the apostles except Peter, who agreed with Jesus that not an iota or a jot of the law should be changed?
I'm sorry, this is Dorothy Dick's question.
I'd like to ask an analysis of this question, because I see it seems to be a big question tonight, in there seems to be two ways of looking at the Mosaic law and the law of the New Testament. Yes. It seems to me to be a crux of the matter.
I made it clear at the beginning that it was not asking a question was to challenge the speakers, not to set up positions in favour of them. If you'd like to challenge Dr. Montgomery on that...
I will challenge Dr. Montgomery on that then.
But I want a question. I want a question to Mr. Plummer.
Well, I will not take that to Plummer and I'll give it to Mr. Montgomery.
There's not a legitimate question under the rules of this debate.
Oh.
This gentleman here this gentleman with his hand up in the white shirt on. That's great.
Mr. Plummer, I'd like you to clarify to us tonight the criteria you use to determine historical truth and why that criteria refutes the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Well, I'm not a historian. I'm aware of the fact that many historians who are not Christians have also looked at it, such as Mr. Wells or Professor Gerard LaRue, and I've read some of their books. Now, the problem is that it would take perhaps more than the next few years to honestly analyse all material put together by all the historians of Christianity, and all material put together by all the historians who are arguing against Christianity. And then, to be fair, I should really do the same for all the other faiths to make sure that, in fact, both of the people on arguing Christianity from different viewpoints are totally off the thing. And I don't have that sort of time. I'm not prepared for that sort of time. But what I am interested in is the recent historical truth. Now, you can find events that are occurring quite close. And these are sort of things I'd like to look at, like Christian faith healers. They're in the here and now. They're the sort of things that for the past 5 years I've concentrated on, looking at people who are making claims here and now. And unfortunately, they just don't stand up to the testing. I don't need to go back that far. I look at modern-day Christians making claims here and now, in faith healing, all sorts of areas, and it just doesn't stand up to modern-day areas of testing.
You have a question to Dr. Montgomery.
A question to Dr. Montgomery. I'm wearing hearing aids, you may notice, so I haven't heard quite a lot of what's been said tonight. Could you answer this question? If we had no Bible, we'd be able to know about Christ. He says, no Bible. In other words, can you prove the existence of Christ without the Bible?
Did everyone hear that? No? Yes? The question is, would it be possible to prove the existence of Jesus apart from the Bible?
And the existence of God, go right back to Jewish God. Could you prove the existence of God, full stop, without the Bible, the existence of Christ without the Bible?
All right, then it's a two-pronged question. Could the existence of God be proven without the Bible, and could the existence of Jesus Christ be proven without the Bible?
Without the Bible.
Without the Bible, yes, sir.
No reference to it, whatever.
Yes, yes, no reference to it, whatever. Right. The answer to both of these questions is yes. The answer to both questions is yes. The existence of God is able to be demonstrated from the contingent nature of the universe. The second law of thermodynamics is a scientific illustration of the contingency principle. So is Elber's paradox. Both of these I referred to earlier. As far as the existence of Jesus Christ is concerned, there are other contemporary references to the existence of Jesus outside of the Bible. For example, there is the reference in Tacitus' Annals. There is the reference in Josephus' History of the Jews. There is also a reference in Pliny the Younger's correspondence with the Emperor Trajan, that the letter of the year 117. That's not the elder Pliny who fell into Vesuvius investigating it, but his nephew, who was in the province of Bithynia. Having listed a few of those fascinating sources, I should emphasize that those sources are not written by people who had eyewitness contact with Jesus. The material that does represent the eyewitness contact with Jesus is the stuff which was gathered together and put in the New Testament. That was one of the criteria for the inclusion of the material. And it's extremely important that you not think that now, because this stuff is in India paper editions with verse numbers and that sort of thing, that it's somehow a holy, mystical book that can't be relied upon historically. The fact is, the stuff got into it because of its eyewitness sound historical character. So any historian, to find out the details of Jesus' life, does not go to Josephus, for example.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That inevitably brings us to the end of our question time. The procedure for the debate now is for Dr. Montgomery to speak for 10 minutes in summing up, and for Mr. Plummer to speak for a final 10 minutes. Thank you, Dr. Montgomery.
Debates are very dangerous occasions. They're not dangerous so much for the people who speak in them, but for the audience. The reason for the dangerous character of debates is that most of us have been accustomed to the structured debating in school or university, and to the notion that a good debater is a person who, like the sophists in the days of Plato, could make the worst argument appear the better. In other words, there is a pall cast over most debating that the whole thing is an intellectual exercise. It's a kind of joust, and it's a fun thing to go to. It's like going to a football match, and you watch this sort of thing occur, and then you go home, perhaps cheering for the home team, or whatever. It seems to me that even though that may be a fun activity, where religion is concerned, it's probably not the right kind of context to face it. Why? Because religious matters are or ought to be matters of life or death. The claim in the ministry of Jesus, the claim that he made is that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and that it's impossible to get right with the universe in any other way than in personal relationship with him. In other words, eternity itself depends upon the kind of questions that we've been dealing with tonight. And this comes down hard on every single person who participates. What I would want more than anything else in connection with a debate like this is not for a single person here to go home with a self-satisfied feeling, whether because he enjoyed what Mr. Plummer said or because he enjoyed what I said. What I want is for every single one of you to go home with the motivation to check into these questions to find out where the truth really lies. What worries me about Mr. Plummer is not his answers. What worries me about Mr. Plummer is his evasions. Mr. Plummer has been asked again and again and again to face certain issues. One questioner raised the question of the criteria that Mr. Plummer will apply to historical events. Suddenly, Mr. Plummer, who has denied the resurrection of Jesus Christ, says that he's not a historian, and therefore he's more interested in checking out psychic healings in the present. I hope that none of you will evade that sort of question. If you face it, this is the route you're going to have to take. You just have no choice. I have no choice. You're going to have to use the same criteria of historical testability for the question of Jesus Christ as you use for Caesar's crossing the Rubicon, Napoleon's losing at Waterloo, or any other event in history. This is no different. You need to determine for yourself just how good or bad those New Testament records are. I don't want you to take my word for it. The people I've cited are people who are at the forefront of the historical profession, at the forefront of the legal profession, and these are not people who are doing this kind of thing because they have some sort of special axe to grind. The only historian that Mr. Plummer referred you to, or the only one whose name I caught, was H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was a wonderful science fiction writer. No one would seriously regard him as a historian, even a historian of ideas. What Wells? G.A. Wells. Well, he's even less known than H.G. What you want to do is to find out the criteria that are employed by historians to deal with matters of this sort. Here's an illustration that certainly no one would consider suffers from some kind of theological bias. Chauncey Saunders is one of the foremost military historians alive today. Saunders says, if you want to check out a document, and by the way, he doesn't deal with the New Testament at all. He says, if you want to check out a document, you only have to determine three things. You have to determine, first of all, is it transmitted with reasonable accuracy to you? Is what you have reasonably the same as the document when it started its course through history? Secondly, what does it internally claim about itself? Does it claim to be an eyewitness document or not? And thirdly, what kind of evidence is there that it is the kind of document that it claims to be? Now, those criteria have been worked through with tremendous detail in reference to Jesus Christ, his life, and his ministry. And it is uniformly held by pagans as well as Christians that the life of Jesus Christ is a historical fact. But the fascinating thing about this is that the primary evidence that establishes the fact that Jesus lived is also the evidence that shows that he claimed to be God and that he placed the testing stone for this at his resurrection, and that he did in fact rise again from the dead and appeared, as Paul says in 56 AD, not only to the list of people that he gives, but to over 500 other people. What Paul is saying there is, if you don't care for me and you don't like the other people I've listed, just find those individuals that are all over the place who have seen this. And the detail with which these resurrection appearances are set forth is such that if you're not going to go along with this, you've simply got to find some other explanation. The other explanations are not satisfactory, and therefore, by process of elimination, you find yourself moving toward an event which, if it occurred, vindicates the claims of the person who was at the center of that event. And Jesus says, when you ask him, how come you're here and you rose again from the dead? He says, I came to seek and to save that which was lost. I came to give my life a ransom for many. He says, look, you may think that you can have a decent life on your own, under your own steam, but you know in your heart that you don't have that kind of life. The fact of the matter is that you don't even fulfill your own moral standards. Even without the establishment of moral standards, as with Mr. Plummer, who cannot establish absolute moral standards, even in a situation like this, we know that we don't even come up to the standards that we set for ourselves, if we're honest. And under these circumstances, we are not in the kind of relationship with the universe that we ought to be. And Jesus says, I knew that, and I came down here to earth to die for you and to make it possible for you to become the person that you ought to be. Jesus presents himself as ideal humanity. If you want humanism, for goodness sake, why don't you start with ideal humanity? Why don't you find the way we all ought to be? And once you've found that, let him make you into the kind of person that you long to be, though maybe you wouldn't even admit it to yourself. Please, don't let an occasion like this go by as a sort of intellectual exercise or an opportunity to support a viewpoint that you maintained when you came in here. Don't suffer from invincible ignorance in this situation. Don't rule out evidence. If you're a humanist, you are supposedly committed, according to the Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2, to checking things out by the evidence. You must not rule this thing out a priori without checking it. You can't do the sort of thing that Mr. Plummer does where he says, my wife isn't long enough to check all of this stuff, and this becomes a cop-out. It means that he has the opportunity not to check it and to justify himself. And as far as all of the religious claims of the world are concerned, granted, you probably couldn't check them all out in your lifetime. But as Mr. Plummer himself said, there's a great difference between a religious claim and the backing up of the claim. And if you take all the religious claims of the world, you'll find that the Christian claim is distinguished from the rest on exactly this point of testability, that you can check out the case for the historical resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and since you can check that out, and you can't check the other claims out, surely you'd be wiser to start with the Christian claim.
Thank you.
All right.
Are dangerous occurrences, and I wonder what it would be like tonight, because my main experience of American evangelists is from what I see on the television on Sunday mornings, and I dragged myself up early to see what they said. And it's also from my experience on seeing them in America, where you can switch your channel on your cable, you have 48 or 32 choices, and you can have five or six evangelists included in that. So I wonder what tonight would be like, and we had a few negotiations with rules, but made the negotiations over the American Cup rules pale into insignificance. But fortunately, we were able to come to consensus, and it's been a pleasure to debate with Dr. Montgomery tonight. It's a pleasure to find American evangelists on whom none of my American friends could find anything wrong with. However, the fact that he is an honourable man does not mean that what he says is true. He may be mistaken. Now, Dr. Montgomery suggested in his summing up that you are Christians because of psychological factors. What I said was that you were born into a Christian culture. Now, for 90% of the people here, 90%, perhaps for the future here, perhaps for 10%, you're born into a Christian Western culture. Perhaps another 10% were born in India or were born in the middle of a Buddhist country. And then psychological factors work to increase that faith, to increase that belief to the stage where you are today. And it does take a big re-evaluation to change. Now, a lot of people change their faith because of events occurring, because of miracles occurring, because they go to some of the Eastern religions and certain events occur and they switch over. But very few people make a rational re-evaluation. I would support the call for a rational re-evaluation, but this time for Christianity. Now, I was fortunate enough to be given three of Dr. Montgomery's books, and I was able to get through 2.5 of them, and on the plane back tomorrow morning I'll try and get through the third. And I have quite a library of Christian books. I have quite a library of books of other religions. I'm currently working through the Krishna books, and I've written one article on Krishna's view of women, and I plan to write others in that area. I wonder how many of you have read atheist and humanist books. I wonder how many Christians have sat down and read and re-evaluated their own faith in the light of Christian, atheist and humanist books. Now, we can read Christian critiques of humanism. We can read Christian critiques of atheism. There's no shortage of those in the Christian bookshops I go to every second week to pick up my new life. There is a shortage of bookshops around it which you can pick up humanist and atheist books because there's not a great industry behind it. The people who are writing them are not writing them because they feel they have some eternal reward. They're not writing them because of wanting to build edifices, to build great big structures. They're writing them because of what they have evaluated. That's how the world has come out for them, just as how humanism has come out for me. So what I suggest is that tonight you do take it further. In fact, you take it further by trying to get hold of a humanist book or an atheist book and reading it through and re-evaluating in the light of your own knowledge, re-evaluating in the light of what you've been taught. And secondly, to question at all times. Question your Christian leaders. Question Christians who try to call for funds for particular causes. Say, can I have an audited balance sheet? We always print audited balance sheets in the Humanist magazine and the Skeptic every year. And how many churches print audited balance sheets in their own? So be prepared to evaluate modern day claims. Now, certainly some of the humanist and atheist historians are not well known, like Professor LaRue, G.A. Wells. But try and seek them out, try and read some of their stuff, see what they've said. Christian critiques of atheism or Christian critiques of humanism. Try and find it for yourself. You'll find it very interesting. Then, if after reading those, you're still a Christian, then I applaud you because you have had the faith to put your own faith to test and to be prepared to go out and see what the opposition is saying, as you've had the courage or otherwise to come here tonight to see what I'm going to say. And I believe that your faith then can be put at a higher level because you have the degree that you've been prepared to put to the test, prepared to evaluate it. Now, I don't believe in absolute moral standards. I don't believe I can define absolute moral standards because absolute moral standards imply a supernatural being handing them down. And if you don't believe in a supernatural being handing them down, then you can't have the absolute moral standards. But our society, I've put it to you, has evolved ethical and moral standards over a long period of time with the constant feedback from the community through elections, through parliamentary democracy, not like theocratic states. And because of this, I suggest that we can have a set of laws in which people have had time to evaluate them, see them work, adjust them, modify them. Whereas if we stuck to the sort of laws that were laid down in the Old Testament that apparently have a cut-off at the New Testament, then if we try to have a society based on those, it wouldn't work, because I had direct quotes there. And not once did Dr. Montgomery say that's not a direct quote. Every one of those quotes I can show to you tonight, and in fact we have a little handbook that sets them all out. So the absolute laws that have been set down in the Bible, the revealed word of God, to my mind, are not relevant to society. Whether or not a God exists, that revealed world is not relevant, and therefore I as a humanist couldn't support it. So I take it a step further, but I don't believe that's the revealed word of God. I believe it was written by humans. And therefore, I don't believe that the Christian God existed, and even if he did, what he's had to say isn't relevant tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Plummer. Ladies and gentlemen, before I hand over to John Henninger, I'd like to thank you for your questions. I share your frustration, many of you, have not been able to ask a question. But I believe there's some supper afterwards. Thank you very much. And once again, I'd like you to altogether express our appreciation for two excellent speakers. Thank you.